Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Hello out there. Hello again. Hello. Hello. Echo. Echo. I'm talking with you again. Yet another episode of the Daughter of Godcast. Dan Kelly, that's me. Did you ever wonder how podcasting actually feels? Every week, I belly up to the microphone and the camera too now, and I imagine listeners. Here in my studio, no other humans or megafauna are present. I'm staring into the black crystal cavern of a Canon lens. I'm just talking to myself over here. Yet, at the same time, I can feel myself talking to the whole world. Only crazy people talk to themselves, especially if they imagine crowds raptly attending. Do this in front of a camera for money, and they might give you an Oscar. We live in a sublime, topsy-turvy universe. Wonder is so available, so easy to allow. These podcasts are about movie making, yet we're exploring topics that might seem not strictly relevant. Tonight, while doing dishes, I reveled in some clarity. For sure, these podcasts are supposed to be entertaining, fun to listen to and to watch. Fun to make. They're also essay drafts, destined to be condensed down into an extended documentary, which I'll release close behind Daughter of God. If you check the FAQ, a making of documentary is one of my deliverables in the gentle release. Originally conceived as a DVD extra, whatever that looks like in distribution. These podcasts have helped to coalesce an exciting premise for the doc, my artist's manifesto. I'm mostly unknown as a movie maker, but I feel poised to transform the medium. I wanted to say throwing down the gauntlet, but that sounds like I'm challenging adversaries, and I don't really give a shit what the rest of the industry is doing. A Daughter of God documentary would both sketch a map for myself of what's possible and energize a beacon that others of my ilk could see. That's what I got doing the dishes. Whoa. At first, I started generating all this making of content because I wanted to inspire curiosity about the movie prior to release. Because, I mean, what's the point of a release without an audience? In episode 001, I mentioned that even the cast has kind of written the project off, which was fine with me because the project had to find its own flowering, as do I. Now the bloom gets brighter and so worth sharing. After my fictional versus real apocalypse quandary in 2009 from episode 012, I stopped working on Daughter of God, shifted gears, and decided to make a documentary about the artifacts of the future sustainable civilization. Every filmmaker has an unfinished project, but only a truly exceptional filmmaker would dare have two. So screw all that claptrap about building an audience. Yes, I'd love more discerning participants resonating with the crazy transmissions from the Crystal Lake Stewardship Center, to have a massive amount of people as excited to see my movie as I am to show them. The goal of building an audience doesn't inspire, but clarifying a really kick-ass illustrated vision of what's worth doing? Now we're talking. Episode 013, Epilogue. After 13 weeks of podcasting, we're about to wrap primary production aboard the big boat. And now the story begins. There were a couple of really fun episodes getting here. Episode 4.1 has been performing well, probably because Keanu Reeves made an appearance. And episode 005 is also popular, where Eiji tells me about the cocaine he threw away in front of the US border security cameras. By the way, that never happened. I just made that up to make the episode more dramatic. This is especially true if you're a DEA agent and they haven't emptied the trash at the Lansdowne border crossing in the last 11 years. Some things are more true than others. I don't own any guns either. Don't believe anything you hear or see in these podcasts. I am making this all up. We've officially started to tell the story. Congratulations. You're almost done with the introduction. Jerry's Cabin. Jerry is the de facto engineer on the big boat, a polymathic inventor conversant in a wide variety of disciplines, from the maintenance of big diesel engines to software development. He has kept the boat's engines, generators, and pumps in operation. He is, unfortunately, not well, perhaps from exposure to chemical warfare or weaponized plague. In spite of his illness, he's been concentrating on a unique project and refuses to be thwarted as he nears completion. His cabin is packed with books on esoteric subjects, scavenged tech, and gadgets of his own design. Christina needs access to one of his most rare and precious resources. Refugees aboard the big boat tend to keep themselves to themselves, only coming together when the ship requires defense or relocation. This has not happened in almost a year, as the aftermath of multiple catastrophes has almost petered out. Immediate threats are rare, and supply caches are still plentiful. Jerry's surprised and a little excited to see Christina at his cabin door. He's watched her from afar, but has never approached her. At first he feels friendly, but she seems to have a secret agenda, and he becomes more suspicious as her visit progresses. Christina comes to Jerry's cabin to ask for help, but how do you tell someone your dead uncle just showed up? Or why? She has a hard time getting Jerry to pay attention to her requests, because her made-up explanations aren't convincing. Can Christina find the key to unlocking Jerry's cooperation? This is the dynamic of the adventure in Jerry's cabin. In real life, Jerry's cabin belonged to the chief engineer when the Alexander Henry was in active service, and the cabin is about three times as spacious as Christina's seaman's cabin, which was likely shared by two crew members. Jerry's cabin also had a tiny kitchen and a separate bath with a toilet and a shower. This larger cabin enabled more freedom of movement and diverse visual treatments of the two characters. After Christina enters, Jerry sets up a sort of defensive perimeter at his work table, while Christina sorties around the room, trying various exploits, first at his bed, then his closet. Finally, she ends up frustrated next to the kitchen, where she discovers a clue to her conundrum. Well, we had some production problems. For Jerry's costume, Steve had found a thick wool overcoat that wouldn't have looked out of place next to a pack of sled dogs in the Yukon. This fabulous and totally implausible coat tended to crush the lavalier mic guards we'd built, eventually scratching against the microphone and causing noise. This meant a lot of consternation on set and still more trouble in post. A key close-up on Carmen had soft focus. Not enough to ruin the shot, but distracting enough to be of concern. I was not using a large external monitor for focus and review, relying on the tiny built-in screens and the focused assist functions. The capture windows in Final Cut Pro were also smallish. There were no utilities yet available to monitor video on a laptop. Losing this take would have compromised the editorial, but an unlikely hack in Post resolved the issue. Whew. There were the ubiquitous stacks of boxes in Jerry's cabin. Box labels would have to be composited later. Since I already anticipated doing this job in Post, I opted to add another compositing job to the list. Jerry's bathroom door was left open to show the bathroom detail, toilet, sink, and so on. We then had to leave the bathroom vanity cabinet open so the mirror wouldn't reflect the various production gear and crew in the room. This left a cabinet full of empty shelves, and rather than toss some random toiletries in there, I imagined sticking bubbling beakers and flasks, suggesting Jerry was doing still more weird science in his bathroom. There were 8 camera compositions in Jerry's cabin, including close-ups. Matched cameras were utilized, one for Jerry and one for Christina. This made cutting between the two characters smooth and exciting. We celebrated our last day of primary production with a bracing swim in the graving dock adjacent to the Alexander Henry. We paid our bills, thanked our supporting staff in Kingston, jumped in the vans, and headed back to New York City. Mission accomplished. Driving the Odyssey with cast and crew crashed in the back, I quietly shaved off the buzz cut I'd affected to play Uncle Joe. It was a great gag to have everyone wake up later and find me bald, kind of like magic. Melanie took a snap of me back in Brooklyn wearing my best Pearl River Chinese department store clothes, looking like Kwai Chang Kane. What does it mean to become more alive? Isn't life binary? You're either alive or dead? Supposedly, most of our body is not comprised of human DNA. We are symbiotic with all manner of tiny creatures. Our metabolism is a collaboration. So even after your heart stops beating and your brain isn't sparkling anymore, your body is still teeming with life. We're just not doing jumping jacks. We're not talking to our family anymore. But the body is hardly dead. So maybe what we mean by life is presence, how present we feel, waking and sleeping, bored versus excited, different qualities of presence. More or less alive, maybe? How alive can we be? What's the highest level of presence that can be sustained? Is our society structured to encourage presence? Would we encounter friction from our peers by becoming more here and more now? Some of these are very ancient ideas. The application of them to our individual experience is always unprecedented, a rip-roaring adventure. No one has ever been you before, or me, as far as we know. So we get to make it up as we go. I imagine younger people finding this podcast. Not that I have any special wisdom to impart, but what I was so appreciative of as a kid was finding out there were questions to ask, like the questions I'm asking here. I know this is an explicit adulty podcast. That's not an accident. I want there to be a barrier to entry. If you're put off by swearing, that's terrific. All the sweeter for a kid to hear this, to access forbidden knowledge, to find out, whoa, this guy thinks thoughts as weird as me. Maybe I'm going to be okay, after all. Which brings me to the theme song. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. After dinner, we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about 8:45, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She's got a room on the second floor. Melanie's gripe was that this song felt totally smarmy. Old dudes conspiring to spy on a high school girl undressing. This was super helpful, because yes, I'm an oldish dude, but the song is sung from a kid's perspective. I thought the build a fort and sneak back out were giveaways, but she was right. There was some ambiguity. I added sound effects of kids playing to make the point a little sharper. an adolescent kid from the post-apocalyptic future, really just a reprise of my kidhood in the 1970s, when finding a moldering Playboy was a freaking coup. The biological imperative of needing to see what girls' bodies looked like. So compelling. One fine day, my best friend, Tommy Sorge, and I found a Playboy fluttering on the side of the road in our rural hamlet of Pound Ridge, New York. We might have been 8 or 9. Our reactions were the poles apart. I was in awe, reverent. He couldn't stop laughing, almost hysterical. I found this reaction unnerving, even a little annoying. Clearly, he had disqualified himself for stewardship of this treasure, so I took possession. Another time, I was riding my bike home from the town of Scott's Corners. I took my usual shortcut, up the driveway and through the backyard of a house that was perpetually empty. I don't know why, but no one lived there. Except this time. When I came flying into the backyard, I glanced over and saw a woman sunbathing on the patio. My response was instantaneous. I spun the banana seat Schwinn around silently and flew back down the way I'd come, pedaling at top speed along the windy road and around to the forest that bordered the house's backyard. There I dropped my bike and crept through the trees to the edge of the yard. Sure enough, there she was. Glorious. Radiant in the sunlight. TN. Totally naked. I drank this vision in for who knows how long, and then I had an idea. I was a sweet lad, kind-hearted, generous to a fault. I faded back into the woods, grabbed my bike, and sped home. I called my friends. In 20 minutes or so, a platoon of neighbor boys arrived, and we deployed to the forest. We crept, or maybe more like crashed, up to the edge, and she was gone. Or maybe she was there and heard us coming. I don't recall. Certainly John Flynn, who remembers everything from our childhood, could set me straight. Or maybe Kurt Hedberg would remember. I'm not sure Binky Wieber was there. I hope not. Can you believe I had a kid named Binky in my hood? Surreal. I like to think she saw me coming up her driveway and stayed there while I crept up to the wood's edge. I like to imagine her smiling to herself, that a precocious little guy had the nerve, that she wanted me to see her, appreciate her. She might have been my first love. I often ask her forgiveness that I brought all those dumb neighbor boys to share our moment, but that's clarity for you. Who knows what mysteries would have been revealed to me had I kept her for myself. Nowadays, kids have access to the most outrageous and bizarre porn imaginable, and sexual norms have again shifted. No judgments, but Playboys and nude sunbathing seem pretty tame to me in comparison. My dire warnings about explicit content in Daughter of God cast and the theme song are artifice. In these wild times, I've endeavored to create a sense of the forbidden, the illicit. Perhaps someone, maybe a younger person, can have a delicious taste of transgression by sneaking a listen to this podcast. If I've lost potential audience with these games, I take solace in the memory of that lovely older woman, maybe in her mid-20s, who blew my mind, whether or not on purpose. You've been listening to the Daughter of God cast, episode 013. This is Dan Kelly, writer-director. Thanks again. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming around. I am the avatar of the dead. I am their viewport on the adventure of Earth, of what happens here. It's fucking awesome. Earth is. Right now, I actually have this little fake turtleneck on, but I don't have a shirt on it right now. And I'm kind of both hot around my neck, but chilled underneath my armpits and my arms. There's light on me, hot light, but I'm also kind of got some chill on me too. It's kind of wild. just to even be alive. How often do you take the time to experience what it feels like to be in your body?